For thousands of years, civilization has been a destructive force, both ecologically and socially. In the midst of the sixth extinction, the future of humanity and our other than human kin hangs by a thread. At this pivotal moment in time, we must look back into the depths of the human story and uncover our mistakes. There is still time to reconnect with what we have lost, to restore our broken relationship to the land where we dwell, and to remember the human place in the wild. Hello, and welcome to the Rewilding Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Michael Bauer. This podcast is produced and made possible from supporters on Patreon. Thank you. If the Rewilding Podcast inspires you, gives you hope, or makes you think, please subscribe, share it on social media, and become a patron at patreon.com/PeterMichaelBauer. If you're new to rewilding or want to expand your perception of it, I recommend attending one of my Rewilding 101 workshops, which I offer both in person in Portland, Oregon, and online for those who live around the world via Zoom. You can check upcoming dates and register at rewildportland.com. Rewilding is about seeking a reciprocal relationship to the environment and to one another. Material and cultural conditions kept humans in relative check with their ecologies for potentially millions of years. So what were they? If we are to understand this, we must hold the lens up and look at the diversity of hunter-gatherers, both past and present, to fully realize what their cultural and environmental limitations were and are today. Why did some abandon that way of life while others have fought to the death to defend it? What led humans to switch from one subsistence strategy to another? And what were the social and ecological effects of these changes? Is it possible to fully know? What do we know? To talk about these core rewilding questions with me is Dr. Robert Kelly. Dr. Kelly first became involved in archaeology in 1973 as a high school student. He received his BA from Cornell University in anthropology in 1978, his MA from the University of New Mexico in 1980, and his doctorate from the University of Michigan in 1985. He has taught at various colleges since 1986, from 1997 until retirement in 2023. He taught at the University of Wyoming. Dr. Kelly is the author of over 100 articles, books, and reviews, including The Lifeways of Hunter-Gatherers, The Fifth Beginning, and Archaeology, the most widely used college textbook in the field. He is the past president of the Society for American Archaeology, past editor of American Antiquity, North America's primary archaeological journal, and past secretary of the Archaeology Division of the American Anthropological Association. He has been a distinguished lecturer at many universities around the country and the world, including Argentina, Germany, France, Finland, Norway, Japan, and China, and he has worked on archaeological projects in Nevada, California, New Mexico, Kentucky, Georgia, Maine, Chile, and for the last 25 years, Wyoming and Montana. He has received over $2 million in funding with multiple grants from the National Science Foundation. Since 1973, the archaeology, ethnology, and ethnography of foraging people has been at the center of his research. Dr. Kelly, thank you for coming on to the Rewilding Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
I just have to say I'm a little intimidated because your list of all of the things that you've done in your life, it's a huge inspiration to me personally. Your work has been, and so I'm very grateful that you're on the show. And I just want to say thank you, a deep thank you for everything that you've done.
Sure.
So to just jump into it. Right before I started recording, I was just kind of telling you a little bit of this thing where I have this pet peeve about how some people will call themselves modern day hunter gatherers. And they're not talking about actual modern day hunter gatherer societies. They're just kind of using it as a colloquial term. And it always is kind of a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, because I'm like, do you actually understand what a hunter gatherer is? But beyond just cultural rewilding, there seems to be a wide range of people looking to hunter-gatherers for some kind of guidance or glimpse into human nature. However, it seems like there's still a lot of confusion over what this means and what it can tell us about ourselves. So I'd like to start out with a clarification of terms. What is a hunter-gatherer?
Well, I suppose most simply put, let me first say, humans are unbelievably diverse. An enormous range of ways to be human. And so any effort to classify humans into different categories: hunter-gatherers, agriculturalists, industrialists. It's, you always end up with kind of gray areas in between there. Mm-hmm. There is no perfect, clear classification. So that's a, that's the first thing we have to remember. But dividing any subject, in this case, humanity, up into some kind of category is just a way to try and get a manageable hold over what some of the diversity is and what are some of the variables that might be responsible for that diversity. Because we begin with the assumption that the diversity isn't just random. It's not just that people choose to be to live one way rather than another, just randomly, that there's actually some causal variable behind that. So by dividing humanity up into these pieces, we're just trying to make the job a little bit controllable, a little more manageable, to try and understand cause. Why are humans the way that they are? Because they are all kinds of different ways. So that's the first thing to understand, that if I can tell you, here's the definition of a hunter-gatherer, but it's not going to be perfect. Hmm. So hunting and gathering peoples, most anthropologists would understand them to be those individuals who live day to day without domesticated plants and domesticated animals as food sources. So we can instantly say, well, wait a second, hunter-gatherers have had domesticated dogs for, we estimate, maybe 30,000 years. Mm. They're not a consistent food source, although, yeah, they will eat Fido if things get rough. but mostly they're being used for hunting purposes or really as camp guards. Mm. That's where they're really good at. I discovered that in Madagascar. Mm. So that's our definition of hunter-gatherer. Now, if you look in my book about hunter-gatherers and look at some of the groups that are included in the discussions there, you'll find some of those actually rely on horticulture, on some agricultural plants, for some small amount of their diet, maybe 10, 15% of their diet. So you could look at that and say, wait a second, you violated your definition. And I just go, yeah, okay. Yeah. There's always going to be this gray area in between there. So that's our simple definition of a hunter-gatherer. It doesn't work perfectly. Then other people have taken hunter-gatherers and tried to then divide them up into different categories. One of the most common ones is simple versus complex hunter-gatherers. I really don't like this definition, and I don't find it very, very useful in terms of understanding why there are folks that we call simple and folks that we call complex. The reason is, if you looked at like Australian, the indigenous people of Australia, these are consistently said to be some of the most simplest hunter-gatherers in the world. And the criteria for that definition is mostly technology. Australian, the indigenous people of Australia, had a very simple technology. They didn't have a lot of stuff that they had to carry with them. They could pick it all up literally in 10 minutes and be on the move. So people look at them and go, well, they're very, very simple because they don't have a lot of stuff. Well, that's because we privilege stuff in the Western world. If you were to look at the social organization of Australia's indigenous population, it's unbelievably complex, especially their marriage rules, marriage classes and subclasses. And they have things that anthropologists have called marriage sections and subsections. And who you can marry is unbelievably complicated. It's the most complicated in the world of hunter-gatherers. I can write, other people have written really thick books about that social organization. Then if you look at their cosmology, their their understanding of the supernatural world with the dream time and its relationship to the modern geography, but also to the rules whereby men and women live their lives. It's also just unbelievably complicated and sophisticated. So they have a very simple technology, but that's counterbalanced by this very, very complex social, political, and ideological understandings of the world. When a lot of other people talk about complex hunter-gatherers, in my opinion, they're masking a very important fact, which is complex hunter-gatherers are inevitably those with non-egalitarian social and political orders. The classic case among hunter-gatherers are those folks who lived along the northwest coast of North America, from like Northern California up to the Alaskan Panhandle. These are commonly said to be complex, but really what's significant about them is that they have social stratification, including in some societies, a slave class. That's what you want to know about. How is it that hunter-gatherers in that part of the world would go from egalitarian structures, that is, ones where everyone is more or less equal, to a non-egalitarian structure where there are slaves? Those people don't have the same rights as other people. That's the interesting thing about them. Simply calling them complex deflects attention
totally
from that very important fact.
Totally.
So there's ways, the classification of hunter-gatherer, the classifications that we use to divide hunter-gatherers up into other categories, they're not perfect. But they're all designed to try and understand the variability that we see among these people.
Totally. Yeah, it just makes me think a lot of things are swirling around in my head. You know, I'm from Portland, so I'm very deeply aware of the stratification that was here pre-contact among tribes, and even still some of the political aspects of that that continue over into today's world with intertribal politics here. I'm thinking too, you know, one of the distinctions that I like or that I found value in was Woodburn's immediate return and delayed return, because it seemed to sort of be potentially one of the material contexts that could create the social stratification that we're talking about within a society where, and I'm just curious if you want to talk about that for a minute, or if what do you think about the immediate return, delayed return classifications?
So in my opinion, what Woodburn saw there was that there's a serious difference between hunter-gatherers who don't store food for more than, you know, a couple of days, and hunter-gatherers who store food for a long period of time. That is, they need to put up a lot of food, usually before the winter. It's mostly to survive a winter. And they're going to eat that food for some number of months afterwards. So that the collection of that food and the maintenance of those stored foods becomes really, really important. It's not so important when you're storing food for a day or two. Oh, if something happens to the stores, oh, bummer, we're not going to eat so much tonight.
Right.
So that's okay. That's okay. We'll get some more the next day.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're living in the Arctic, where you're going to hunt caribou during the fall caribou hunt, and whatever you get over that very short term, that's the food you're going to eat through the winter. Making sure that that hunt works, that you acquire enough food for a long period of time for the entire group, that changes things. It changes the order of things. And it's usually associated with non-egalitarian political structures. People used to say, anthropologists used to talk about the Northwest Coast, and they understood the all of the elaboration of culture there, and all of the ritual, the non-egalitarian social orders, they attributed those to an abundance of food. That never made sense to me. Even as a graduate student, it never made sense to me. If there's an abundance of food, why is there competition over it? Well, the answer really is that if you want to live on the Northwest Coast as a sedentary hunter-gatherer, which the folks up there did, then you have to put up a lot of food to feed your community, and you have a very short period of time to do it, and you have a very small physical window to get that large amount of food out. So the high-ranked villages on the Northwest Coast are all sitting on big, reliable salmon streams where there is a place that you can take the salmon out in large numbers. You can't do that at just any old place along the stream. You have to have just the right place. You build a fish weir. You're channeling all of these salmon through a very narrow a gate, and that's where you're using nets and spears and leisters to take the fish out in very large numbers, because that's your food supply for the next several months. And that can create serious problems if those salmon don't come up the river, and they sometimes don't. And you can't really predict when they're going to come and when they're not going to come. So if you're on a smaller salmon stream, and you're waiting at the right time of the fall for that salmon run, and it doesn't come, you are in a great deal of danger for the next 4 months. And that's when you get competition, and that's when you get complex political orders forming.
It's interesting to think about the analogy or the analogous subsistence strategy of threshing grain, and how that's, you know, something that happens all at once, one time of the year, a couple of weeks, and then you have to store it for that duration too. And that there's also, you know, social stratification among those societies as well.
Yes. The structure of the food supply on the Northwest Coast is very similar to the structure of the food supply in an agricultural community. It has to all be harvested relatively quickly in a small span of time, and then processed so that it can be consumed over the next several months. That's true for corn or wheat. It's true for salmon as well.
I have a question for you. I think oftentimes when people talk about, you know, environments of evolutionary adaptation or hunter-gatherers, there's this idea that hunter-gatherers were immediate return or didn't really store food for the majority of our evolution, and that like food storage delayed return is something that's happened much later. I know there's been some sort of controversy with David Graeber's book, The Dawn of Everything, which sort of acts as if none of that's really important, and that we can sort of just, I don't know, my interpretation was it was none of that's really important. We can just kind of choose whatever society we want, you know, material conditions be damned or something. But I'm curious what your take is on this notion of immediate and delayed return within the context of our social evolution. And do you think that that's actually, you know, how humans were living during that time? Or do you think it's always been sort of this like, you know, experimentation through time, I guess? I don't know if that question makes sense.
Well, there's always been experimentation. Humans are always looking for a way to make things better. This is partly why humans have been so successful as a species, at least up to now. because we're constantly saying, how can we improve things? How can we make things better? Last winter we nearly starved to death. Let's not do that again. What can we do to make this better? Well, let's store a lot more food And we can do that by going after these anadromous fish runs in the fall, or we can do it by taking a lot more of the animals during their fall migratory movements. So the hunter-gatherers almost certainly began storing food once they started to migrate into environments that really demanded that they store food, because they're moving into colder environments where there's a serious lean season, where the animals have either migrated away, the animals are not in very good condition to eat. Eating lean meat is not a good thing to do. If you're worried about heart disease, yes, it's a good thing to do. But if you're a hunter-gatherer, they really don't like lean meat. It's hard to digest. So when they started to move into colder environments, it demands that they start storing food. They have to become delayed return hunter-gatherers. And that brings its sort of own issues that you then have to adapt to. Everything that humans do solves one problem and then creates a new problem.
Totally.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, tapping into fossil fuels is what allowed human population to grow from a billion people globally in 1850 to 8 billion people today.
Totally.
It's because we tapped into a stored solar energy. Well, of course, that's created a problem.
Yeah.
So everything, you solve one problem and it creates a new one.
Yeah, it makes me think of the classic nursery rhyme, the old lady who swallowed a fly.
Yeah.
Right? Swallows a spider to catch the fly, and then the bird to catch a spider, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the end, she goes extinct. So
hopefully that's not us.
Hopefully that's not us. But I lost track of what I was saying.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Delayed return. So yeah, it happens as hunter-gatherers move into colder environments. It can also happen as hunter-gatherer population in a local area begins to grow. Because the primary way that hunter-gatherers deal with a shortage of food is to move. Just move on. Or the way that they deal with competition over food sources is you move. You move into new territory where there's no other humans there. And this is really what propelled humans across the planet, starting, I can't put a very precise date on it, but let's say starting about 75,000 years ago, people start to move out of Africa. They're really into Europe at 50,000 years ago, maybe a little earlier in the Near East. And then they just migrate out across Asia, eventually across the Bering Strait when it was land, probably, and then down into the Americas very, very rapidly. That's a when we look at humans as animals, that's a very rapid migration of people across the globe, down into Australia, eventually out into the Pacific Islands in the last few thousand years. A very, very rapid migration. And that's hunter-gatherers responding to a sense that there was not enough food. There's too much competition in this area. So you can either sort of increase the activities of competition, which can entail violence, or you can simply move. Simply moving that's the less costly option, because hunter-gatherers they're pretty comfortable with just moving into someplace new, where to find the things that they're going to need in order to live. Hunter-gatherers deal with population pressure by moving, and they feel population pressure at very low levels. Consequently, they move very, very quickly. The people back home, the people who are stayed behind in Africa, in the Near East, their populations continue to grow. And eventually they start to feel some population pressure that's going to lead them to tap into other sources of food or to make their environment more productive. This is when domestication of plants and animals starts. The process is complicated and detailed in all the different places where it started, and it independently happened in a number of places in the world. But I do suspect that the root cause is a population pressure and a need to diversify the food base and then make that environment more productive.
So in terms of population growth, population pressure, what do you think was the catalyst? I mean, humans are, you know, our genus is at least 2.5 million years old. So, you know, and Homo sapiens are probably around 200,000.
Yeah.
Do you think that there was some distinct thing that happened that then caused the populations to grow in this sort of exponential kind of way? Or, you know, what were the material limitations that prevented human growth before whatever that 40 or 75,000, you know, expansion out of Africa? Like, what was, do you have any ideas around that?
The human population growth throughout up until into the 19th century, human population growth was really very slow. It was our estimates of the growth rate is we've estimated it based on some estimates of population change in North America, and others have done it in other parts of the world. And the growth rate is like 0.04%. It's just barely above replacement level. You need like 2.1 children per woman in order to just kind of replace the population. Because you've got to accept that there's going to be a certain amount of death of children before they reach reproductive age. So that's pretty typical for hunter-gatherers to have each woman is producing 2, 3, 4 children to adulthood. 50% of children probably died before they reached reproductive age, and that was true into the 19th century. What was different was that instead of a woman having 4 or 5 children in her lifetime, she might be having more like 9 or 10. Half of those don't live, but there's still the growth rate starts to tick up. Once you start getting agriculture, the growth rate starts to climb. And that's a complicated process that has to do with how much work women are doing versus how much food they have coming in, whether that food intake is sort of constant over the year or whether it fluctuates. It's a rather complicated biological process. But once you shift to agriculture, the end result is women end up producing more children throughout their lives, still losing half of them. There's instead of raising 3 or 4 children, or I'd say 2 to 4 children to reproductive age, they're raising maybe 4 or 5 children. So the rate of population growth starts to tick up with agriculture. However, the problem with agriculture is it's a somewhat unstable system. And so things can be great for a while. Population will grow, the rate of growth will tick up, and then you get famine. And in famine, huge numbers of people die. And the population grows, and then it crashes. And then it's the classic Malthusian growth curve. So when we look at hunter-gatherer populations over thousands of years, it fluctuates. Then you get agriculture, and it starts to tick up, but it still fluctuates, but those fluctuates are much, much bigger.
Do you think so? There are some societies who have practiced agriculture, gone through one of these collapses, and then returned or transformed their subsistence strategies to, like, you know, I don't want to say a lesser, not even less complex, but less involved, or, you know, less labor intensive to produce food. Do you feel like there's lessons to be learned, or are there some sort of cultural limitations to growth? That have you ever seen or come across something along those lines among, you know, a horticultural or delayed return hunter gatherer society that's done some sort of you know, cultural limitation to whatever that is, that cycle?
You mean intentionally put limits on their growth, their
Yeah.
population growth?
Yeah.
No.
Interesting.
In a word, no. This was very popular a few decades ago to say that hunter-gatherers intentionally controlled their growth.
Mm-hmm.
They intentionally held it low in order to not exploit their resources. This kind of didn't make sense because obviously some hunter-gatherers in the past didn't control their growth.
Mm-hmm.
They became, the population grew, and that's when they became agriculturalists. So why are the hunter-gatherers who were left, why were they intentionally controlling their growth? Well, once this people started studying this, it turns out that hunter-gatherers are actually maximizing their growth rate. It's just that for them, under their circumstances, a maximum growth rate is very low.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still trying to maximize the growth rate. They're not doing anything to intentionally hold the growth rate back. So it has not been demonstrated that things like there are various herbal concoctions that women could take in order to not get pregnant or to induce an abortion. These don't really work. The other method that people said was infanticide, and usually female infanticide. And this actually, the empirical basis for this actually appears to be wrong. It goes back into some early 20th century accounts of the Inuit in northern Canada. It turns out to be wrong. And those places where anthropologists have been able to get some good estimates of infanticide, that is, you know, basically killing an infant right after birth, it's actually extremely rare. Its frequency is nowhere near what you'd have to do in order to control population growth. And it usually happens because a woman thinks she's not going to get enough support from the father of the child. And she's already got another child that she's breastfeeding. And if a child is going to die, it's going to die, and it's primarily in its first few years of life. So if you've got a three-year-old child who is still breastfeeding, because children in hunter-gatherer societies usually breastfeed for 3, 4, even 5 years, you've already got that child through the most difficult part, and you have to make a decision between this child and a newborn. The newborn has a 50% chance of dying. The three-year-old has a much less than 50%
Totally.
chance of dying. So they make a difficult decision.
Yeah.
And they don't make that decision lightly, and it's made rarely.
Yeah. I'm glad you are explaining this, because this is something that I actually have tried to look up and haven't been able to successfully find information about. And so that's really cool.
It's very rare, because that's hard information to get. I was just talking with an anthropologist last night about this. He works in Africa, and he said they just can't talk about this
Totally.
with people they don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who would want to?
Right.
Who would want to?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think I have this impression that it was a lot more frequent based on this older information. And I, you know, at one point I tried to find where the statistics were for all this, and I couldn't really, I couldn't find it. So, yeah,
it's,
this is.
It's mostly where it exists. It's probably most common in the Arctic, where you have the greatest need to where families feel we can't support another child.
Yeah.
But even there, it's far less than what the early estimates said, and it's mostly being done by sort of modeling how it, given the adult sex ratio, what and given an at birth sex ratio of 50-50, right? How many children and of what sex would have to be suppressed in order to create that adult ratio? But we're now discovering that there's the sex ratio at birth is about 50-50. Actually, it's slightly biased for females. And there's now some new research showing that if a population is living under some pretty significant stress, that the sex ratio at birth becomes more female dominated.
Interesting.
And exactly what's going on there is it's something that people are not controlling. It's something biological that's happening. And I can, in an evolutionary sense, I can understand that, because if you're living under a severe stress, which is usually subsistence stress, not enough food to eat, nature may have designed ways so that women end up producing more female offspring, because if you want to make sure the population doesn't go extinct, and that's all evolution cares about,
totally,
right?
yeah,
that's all it
yeah
cares about, then you want females,
totally,
not
yeah,
males.
yeah, that's fascinating.
So some of those computer simulations looking at adult sex ratios and then using that to predict rates of female infanticide might be incorrect.
Yeah, that makes sense. This is kind of along the same lines of this, but one of the other questions I wanted to ask was, what are common myths that you see portrayed about hunter-gatherers?
When a lot of people look at hunter-gatherers, they think, and they desperately want to think, that they're looking at human nature in the raw, human nature stripped of all the accoutrements and complications of modern life. I'm sorry, but this isn't true. Yeah, I mean, hunter-gatherers have something to tell us about human nature because they're humans. But they don't tell us anything more about human nature than you and I have to say. So, and a lot of people think that by looking at hunter-gatherers, they're looking back in time. Living hunter-gatherers are like a time machine. This is also incorrect. Modern hunting and gathering peoples, and there's not many of them left, they live in a modern world. If you go down to Pier 1 import stores and buy some of their rattan cane furniture, very good chance that product was, the raw materials for it was collected by Penan hunter-gatherers in Borneo. They're part of the world system. The Mikea forager horticulturalists that I worked with for a time in the 90s in Madagascar, they sell some of their maize onto the world livestock feed market. They're incorporated into the global economic system. So you're not looking into the past. You're looking at people who live under certain conditions, and we can understand something about them. So Many people look at hunter-gatherers, they think they're looking into the past, they think they're looking at human nature in the raw, and they think that humans were better in the past than they are today. Somewhere along the way, we got screwed up and things went wrong. And scholars have thought this way actually for a long, long time. Some people put it at the Roman Empire. That's when things went wrong. It's so people look at hunter-gatherers, they want to see them in a good light. So they some of the myths are that hunter-gatherers live peacefully. There are plenty of hunter-gatherers who do live peacefully, and others who live peacefully at times. And at other times, it's not so peaceful. You can see group-on-group violence. There's interpersonal violence. We can see this in the ethnographic record, and we can see it in the archaeological record as well. The sorts of warfare that we see of enormous numbers of people going after one another, where it's not personal. I'm part of the Egyptian army. I'm talking about the ancient Egyptian
Totally.
army,
Yeah.
and you're going to go fight somebody. Why are you doing this? Well, you're doing it because you were told to. Do you really hate those people over there? I don't even know who they are, but this is what I was told. And if I don't do this, I'm in a great deal of trouble. So I weigh my options, and fighting is what I have to do. And state societies are very good at convincing people that this is a really important thing to do. They have ways to inculcate the idea that dying for the emperor or dying for the pharaoh, dying for the king is a really good thing. Yeah, it's a good thing for the emperor or the pharaoh or the king, but not for you. But they have ways of convincing you that it is. So for hunter-gatherers, that violence is often kind of personal. It's usually contained so that you make a point. Right? You're angry with this group for whatever reason. There's a lot of hoopla and show and a lot of wielding of spears or bows and arrows. And then one person gets killed and it's like, okay, we made our point. Don't mess with us. And then everyone goes back. The kind of serious warfare that you don't see too much of that among hunter-gatherers, but violence-free, That's not true. They had their problems and at times found violence to be the only way to maybe solve that problem. We can see it in our archaeological remains. It becomes more common, I think, once people shift to agriculture, because then land, holding on to this piece of arable land, becomes more crucial. And that whole and assessing the cost and the benefit of violence, the benefit comes down on the side of violence. So that's one myth. The other myth is that their diets are dominated by meat. This is kind of the whole paleo diet thing, is that the diet is dominated by meat. We do not know that for a fact. One of my colleagues here just published a paper a week or so ago where they were shocked to discover using stable isotopes from bone. They found that early folks pre 8,000 years ago in the high Andes, which is not an environment where there's lots and lots of plant food to eat, but there's lots of camelids to eat there, like guanaco and vicuña. They were surprised to find that the diet is 80% plant food, mostly tubers. And that was a surprise to them because they kind of expected They thought this early diet would be dominated by meat. Well, apparently not. So that's another myth, is that their diet is sort of high protein, high meat diet, carbohydrates bad, we don't want to eat that. And that may not be true. We're still figuring this all out.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere recently there was a Neanderthal, same kind of thing, an isotope, and the headline was something like Neanderthals were vegetarians or whatever. Of course, the headline's going to, say things incorrectly, but it was a similar thing where it was a very long time ago, obviously, and it was something along the lines of they had done these studies and found that they were eating a lot of plants.
Yeah, I think that was a study of plaque on
Okay,
the
yeah, you're
teeth,
right.
because you can
Totally.
extract all the stuff
That's
that they
right.
were eating out of the plaque.
Totally. Yeah. One thing that just in conversing, it feels like there's, you mentioned the thing of like people trying to pin what went wrong, like at a certain time, and I think for a long time, why I got into all of this was Daniel Quinn's book, Ishmael. And in that, he talks a lot about the agricultural revolution as being a sort of like pivotal point, right? And I think this also ties into your new book, The Fifth Beginning, or newer book. I'm curious, do you think that all of this it was inevitable, like population pressure, human intelligence? Like at some point, it's like we were talking about earlier, humans are problem solvers. We're just always trying to like improve things on some level. Like, when did that? Because not every animal is doing that, right? Like, not every animal has the physical ability to like hack the system, so to speak, to create a world that is more and more geared towards their existence. I'm curious, like, if you think that, at what point did that, maybe it happened, 75,000 years ago with Homo sapiens specifically, but are there signs that show what these specific transformations were over time? And do you feel like a sense of sort of material determinism? Like, once this thing got started, it was sort of inevitable that humans would create a more and more problems for themselves or something. I don't know if that makes a lot of sense, but I don't know if you want to tie that into the fifth beginning in some way, if that makes sense.
The real the thing that separates humans from other it's, from other beings, right, from other animals, is that we're cultural. And that's a term that a lot of people misunderstand, because it means something very particular to anthropologists. And to anthropologists, what culture means is, it's this capacity to hold this abstract vision of what life is supposed to be like. And it includes everything from like proper table manners. How should you act at the table, right? Should you eat with your mouth closed or your mouth open? Americans will tell you, close your mouth when you eat food, right? Chinese often eat food with their mouth open and make noise. That's just considered proper. So it's from simple things like that to things like what's the proper way to live your life? What's the right way to be male or female? What will happen to you in the afterlife? What do you have to do today in order to be in the proper place in the afterlife? It's this whole set of abstract ideas that we're often not even aware are operating at any point in time. And yet everything we do, from the way that we sit to the way that we think about what happens when you die, are th those are all cultural ideas. And those are abstract. We hold them in our head and we pass them down to the next generation, and so on. They're always sort of being modified over time, but they are passed down with some kind of modification. So one of the problems with being a cultural being is you've got this vision of what life is supposed to be like on the one hand, And on the other, you've got your daily lived experience. And those two often do not match up. So I think life should be, it should be pleasant. I should have enough food to eat. I should die of old age surrounded by my fat, happy grandchildren, right? So, and yet, that's not what happens. My brother dies in an accident. That's not supposed to happen. That's not the way life is supposed to be. So you have this vision of what life is supposed to be, and you have a lived experience of what life actually is. And because you have those two, you're constantly trying to make your lived experience closer to what you believe my lived experience ought to be. This creates a lot of tension between people who have different cultural ideas of what life is supposed to be. This is the debate between Democrats and Republicans today. They have different visions of what life is supposed to be. And it's what will constantly drive humans to try and move your lived experience closer to what you think it ought to be. And that lived experience is going to include, my children should all grow up and it's into adults, right? And produce grandchildren for me. My life shouldn't be full of health miseries. I should have enough to eat. I should have a warm place to go sleep at night. All of these things, and we're constantly trying to achieve those. But that, unfortunately, the vision of what life is supposed to be like is a moving target. You never kind of achieve it.
Totally.
And it's always changing, right? So now it's not just, I should have enough to eat and a roof over my head. It's, I should have enough to eat and a roof over my head and a big screen TV.
Yeah.
And maybe two or three of those.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so and that becomes necessary. It's not necessary to life, but we start to envision it as being necessary. So once humans became cultural, I think they started to accelerate the change in human behavior and in human adaptation to the circumstances of life, because they're constantly trying to move that lived experience closer to what they think it ought to be. No other animal can really do this. It just has experience, and that's what it is. It is what it is, right? For an animal. But for humans, we don't have to be, we're not satisfied with it is what it is. There's always this idea we should move it forward. So not enough food? Well, let's find a way to tap into something that could be a food resource. So you figure out that in California, acorns. If you eat an acorn, it's terrible. You would not want to make a meal out of this. But you can, if you take them, mash them up, pour lots of hot water through them, you leach out all the tannic acid, and that stuff becomes edible. It's not really delicious, but it will keep you alive. And so that's what folks in California did. But you had to figure that out, and you had to have a drive to want to figure that out. Deer can eat these. Why can't we eat these? And you start to experiment. These are basically scientists who are figuring out, what do we have to do to make this edible, this food resource edible? Or what can we do to make our land produce more food? So we start doing irrigation of fields, or you live in a mountainous environment, you build terraces so that you can grow food on flat surfaces so the rains don't run it all down the hill. We come up with ways to solve the problem and move our lived experience closer to what we think it ought to be. It always, no matter what we do, it's always going to create a new problem that we then have to find a solution to. So agriculture increases numbers of people, increases competition. Now we have to solve that problem. When did this all start to happen? We don't really know. I'm going to say, probably on the order of 150,000 years ago, but possibly earlier. And I say that because that's when we start seeing what would most simply be termed ornaments and art starting to appear, mostly in the form of beads, like ostrich eggshell beads in Africa. These are now, some of the earliest are around 140,000 years old. That's when those start to show up in the archaeological record. And art, as I argue in the fifth beginning, to me, that's evidence of culture, the way I've just defined it.
Yeah. Would you say it's similar to the notion of symbolic thought?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what lies behind it.
Yeah.
Is symbolic thought, is the ability to tell stories, to use metaphors, to talk about the time when humans were animals and have that make sense. People all kind of go, oh, yes, okay. I can understand that, a time when everyone was animals. All of that is all wrapped up in the same thing. Being able to talk about supernatural beings and forest spirits who live in the trees or in the rocks, you can't really do that until you have symbolic thought.
So in your book, The Fifth Beginning, you have these different cultural horizons, correct? Do you want to talk about those a little bit? And not, because you've sort of talked about the first one, right? Or maybe not the first one, but
no, it's the second one.
Right.
Second one.
Yeah. Because stone tools and fire are kind of
in the
competing
first
in the, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that succession?
The fifth beginning is, I wrote this book because I felt like archaeologists always justify their existence by saying we can't know where we're going unless we know where we've been. But I had spent, and most archaeologists spend all their time figuring out where we've been and not thinking about what that tells us where we're going. So I spent some time trying to think about that. And when you look at all of human history, and for an archaeologist, that's like 6 million years long, because that's when the line that would become humans split off from the line that would become chimps, chimps and bonobos. We can see that humans as a whole have kind of undergone these massive transitions. The first of those was really technology, stone tools and fire, two really significant adaptations that allowed us to tap into other food sources and to make the food that we were collecting of greater nutritional value to us. That's what cooking does. The second is culture, the appearance of art and evidence of symbolic thought and everything I just talked about. The third was agriculture. And the fourth is state governments. I'm not necessarily saying that each of these was a good thing. They all entailed an adaptation that then had its own sort of created its own new problems that we had to adapt to. There's no way to avoid this. Anything we do is going to produce something that we're going to have to then respond to. And each of those transitions is marked by really a global change in the signature of humanity on the world. So as an archaeologist, I look and then say, well, what's happened since the origin of the state, which the earliest states are about 5,000 years old? Is there any other change in the material signature of humanity? And the answer I come to in the book is yes. And it started about AD 1500. And it's the appearance of goods that are manufactured in one part of the world that are then shipped to other parts of the world, massive increase in the technology that connects the world together. Early on, it's ships. which archaeologists see as shipwrecks at the bottom of the ocean, of which there are tens of thousands. And these most of these date to after AD 1500. But it's also things like airplanes and ports and cables that literally link the continents together, and now the internet. So the world has just become more and more integrated, and that leaves a visible signature to us. We can see it in the size of cities. Tokyo, 40 million people. When the first state was created in 5,000 years ago in what's today Iraq and in Iraq, that was probably the global population.
Right.
And now you can find that in one city. And actually, you can find it in a number of those mega cities, Tokyo, Mexico City, and so on. There's others as well. I mean, just the size of our trash dumps. One of the largest human constructions in the world is the Staten Island garbage dump. That's the kind of thing an archaeologist would look at and go, what the hell?
And this
appears in like the last 500 years, which to an archaeologist is the blink of an eye. So very, very rapid change over in a very, very short period of time. 150 years ago, Denver was a tiny, tiny settlement of the indigenous folks. Today, it sits in a population of several million people, spread from basically Colorado Springs up to Fort Collins. So that's just, and that all happened in 150 years. So any archaeologist in the future is going to look at this period and go, what the hell is going on now? And that's when we can expect some other dramatic change in the way human society is organized. So states are not the end. And you can look around the world today and one is very, very pessimistic because of Ukraine and Israel and Gaza and the threats to Taiwan. And it's happening everywhere. Democracy is under threat, even in our own country. So, but some people might look at this and go, things are about to collapse. We're about to fall apart. Maybe we might be on the verge of World War III, and that probably would mean extinction. Or these are growing pains, and we're on the verge of finding a new way of living. And we can see that starting after World War II, the appearance of United Nations and Bretton Woods and a shift from power as a way to solve problems to a rules-based order as a way to solve problems, and it's a little touch and go. Seriously, the next 10 years are probably, and maybe even the next year, are going to be really crucial in human history.
Well, I think too about, you know, I'm a big fan of Joseph Tainter's book, The Collapse of Complex Societies. And I just think a lot about diminishing returns and the oil industry and climate change. And there's all these other factors that are at play too. And, you know, I used to be in a lot of fear over this. And I read, I'm not a big fan of Jared Diamond. And I saw there was a critique of his book, Collapse, by archaeologists called Questioning Collapse. And I bought it and I read it and I loved it because essentially it's about how there's these, like, we have this sort of myth of collapse. I think it's more of a myth. I mean, obviously there are famines, there are diseases, there are warfare. There's warfare that can cause massive population declines, and that's a terrible thing. But the book kind of shows how most of the societies that he talks about, at least in terms of collapse, are like still around. They just transformed their subsistence. They basically had to come up and innovate. And it's like, you know, I think that the biggest hope that I get from, you know, any of this kind of the conversations around these things, is particularly thinking about the next horizon, is that humans are problem solvers, you know? And I feel like even if things get bad, we're still problem solvers at heart. And I feel like that's kind of like one of the things that I take from your work too, is just how diverse we are, how much problem solving is just like in us in that sense.
Yeah, we are problem solvers. We're also problem creators, but we are,
okay,
we are problem solvers. Yeah. We are problem solvers.
Yes.
And we often, we often can see the solutions to problems. We can see some of the solutions to climate change now. You just need the political will to really put those into play.
Yes.
And we can do it. I mean, we know we can do it if we just put our minds to it. You know, when Kennedy said we're going to put a man on the moon before the century, before the decade is out, I mean, looking at the technology we had at the time, we would have said, are you crazy?
Mm-hmm.
That can't be done. We did it because we just decided to solve those technological problems.
Totally.
If you had told somebody, well, if you told me in 1980 that the Berlin Wall would come down and East and West Germany would be unified before the decade was out, I'd have said, no way. It's just not going to happen. And it literally happened overnight.
Yeah.
It caught everybody off guard, including everybody in Berlin. And they were all ready for it. I actually met somebody when I was in Germany, who's he said my mom was making dinner when she heard that the checkpoints were open, just open. And he said she just turned off the stove, grabbed a suitcase, and said, "Let's go." They walked out the door and they walked into West Germany.
Wow.
I mean, she was waiting for it to happen.
Yeah.
She was prepared.
That's incredible.
But nobody knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
If you had told me in the year 2000 that before the decade was out, we would have an African-American president, I'd have said, no, the country's is not ready to go there. Stuff can happen.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's good stuff can happen very, very rapidly. So I hold out hope that can still happen. The opposite can happen as well. But let's just keep our fingers
Yeah.
crossed and hope that sanity rules.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think that's where a lot of rewilding looks at and tries to embrace more subsistence strategies. You know, a lot of people in the urban environments aren't familiar with how to grow or get their own food. And so part of this whole thing is like, well, that might be a thing that we all have to do. It makes me think of, you know, same kind of thing of mass mobilization as, you know, in World War II, when a lot of the agricultural lands were shifted to military production of different products for the military. They had the victory gardens, right? Which I read a statistic somewhere that said people were growing 50% of their food out of victory gardens within like 2 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, those kinds of things, to me, I think there's definitely so much potential to shift and adapt. There's also a really great documentary called The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil. And it basically kind of goes into, you know, how the government there, because after the Soviet Union collapsed, they lost oil imports overnight, like 50% of their oil imports overnight. And so they had to do all this innovative stuff. You know, they hired like teams of permaculturalists to like go train people and started like rooftop gardening and like urban farming. And they were like training people how to use oxen to plow fields and stuff like that. Of course, you know, if you ask an average Cuban, what was it like during that time? You know, they lost 20 pounds and, you know, it was definitely not easy, but they innovated, you know, to the best of their abilities. And I just think about that I mean, that's also an interesting example because it's an island. But yeah, I think a lot about in terms of innovation and all the different things that we can do, I feel like there is a lot of hope in that sense. So
there is hope in it, and we can learn stuff from hunter-gatherers that I think are useful. They all operate locally, and that's a good lesson, is that we should operate locally. So we should be doing much more food production locally to reduce the the carbon footprint of the food and to reduce the costs of it'll make it cheaper, right? And we see this starting to happen. I'm hoping to see a lot of these empty Walmarts and other big stores could be turned into sort of interior gardens. And that's in terms of energy, that's a rather costly solution, but it would allow you to grow food in places like Laramie, Wyoming, where we have a really hard time growing food, given that our growing season is less than 90 days.
Wow.
So it's a solution for some places, not in others. Using sort of dispersed green energy is another way to do it. I still look at buildings and why aren't there solar panels on every single building? Places in Colorado now, there are developments where you must put solar panels on the roofs. But still, it's just a tiny percentage of the roof space that's covered by solar panels. Hunter gatherers live in communities where they know everybody. Basically, everyone they interact with they're often a relative of some kind, but they're somebody they know. And that makes a much better community, because instead of responding to someone as just you're a stranger, or you're put into this category, so I will behave towards you in this way, you know the person personally, and you respond to them not only in terms of what their job might be, but also as a unique human, right? So in small towns, if the police know everybody, they kind of know, okay, Joe's got a drinking problem. We're going to make sure that he gets home. All right. We're going to talk with him again, but they're not just going to bust him, right? Because they understand something about this guy. And maybe he's had tragedy in his life and they feel sorry, but they can respond to him as an individual. So there are ways to construct communities, even in huge cities. There are ways to construct communities, to use architecture, to use green space, as ways to create these hunter-gatherer-like communities in which everyone kind of knows each other and can operate with each other as individuals. If you go to Europe, go to Germany, I visited a castle in Germany that sits way up on high on a on a hill, and you look out over it, and all you could see, this is in southern Germany, is sort of green fields, lots of agricultural fields, and then these small clusters of communities. There's not, even hundreds of people living there. It's small numbers of people. They've all got a sort of local store where many of them are buying local produce, and they all kind of know each other. Maybe not extremely well, but they're all sort of interacting with each other. I looked at that and said, if I could take a lesson from hunter-gatherers, this is the way I would lay out a community. But you have to approach that intentionally.
Totally.
If you just sort of let things go, you'll end up with mega cities. You'll end up with only industrial farms. You have to approach it consciously, and you have to say, we're maximizing this value and we're going to consciously not maximize this other value. It can be done. It just takes will.
Well, and I think, the more things get, the more things intensify globally, and if collapse becomes more and more on the horizon or whatever, some people say we're in collapse, it's a slow decline at first, blah, blah, blah. But, as things get worse, I think that is more and more will for the correction, to move in a different way.
Yeah.
And so, I I see it even just in my life, you know, when I was 16 and I would try to have conversations with people about this kind of stuff, nobody would talk about it at all or even see it. And I think, you know, even just like, I think the big change for that came with Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, in 2004, I think is when that came out. And I just, you know, all of a sudden you could talk to most people about climate change, whether they believed it or not was different. But, you know, as the weather patterns intensify year to year, you know, there's more droughts, there's more rain, there's more flooding, there's, you know, people are like, okay, we actually need to do something about this now. And I feel like the worse it gets, the more will there is to respond to something like that. And I just hope that there's a balance where it doesn't get, you know, tip over the scales in the direction we don't want it to go. But
yeah, it would be nice if we could solve this problem without going through a crisis.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I still have like loads of questions that I had written up here, and we're already at time, so I don't want to take up any more of your time. Perhaps I could have you back on at some point. But sure. before we go, I'm just curious if there's any last bits that you want to make sure that you say before we end the conversation. Any plugs for any of your work or anything like that that you'd like to share?
Oh, I suppose if anyone wanted to read something that my hunter-gatherer book was written for an academic audience. It was really written for students who want to study that segment of human society. The fifth beginning takes advantage of a lot of what's in there, but it's a broader and it's short, and it's written. I wrote it so that my mother could understand it. So
that's awesome.
It's designed for the public to read, and it takes advantage, I think, of some of the things I've learned about hunting and gathering peoples.
Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Kelly, so much for coming onto the show. It's an honor.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's fun, and I like to think maybe it'll have some effect somewhere.
I believe it will. Yeah. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Rewilding Podcast. Check out the show notes to connect with my guest and for a list of resources that we mentioned in our conversation. If this episode inspired you, made you think more deeply, or gave you some new tools to use, make sure to subscribe and become a patron at patreon.com/PeterMichaelBauer. If you're new to rewilding or want to expand your perception of it, I recommend attending one of my Rewilding 101 workshops, which I offer both in person in Portland, Oregon, and online for those who live around the world via Zoom. You can check upcoming dates and register at rewildportland.com. Thanks for listening.